This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 1st of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on the programme, in 1776, it was merely a collection of 13 former British colonies. Fast forward to today, and it's the most powerful nation on Earth. We'll speak to Simon Winchester, author of The Men Who United the States, to see how the US did it.
Also ahead, it was the year of JFK's assassination, the rise to fame of the Beatles and Bob Dylan, and we'll find out why 1963 was the year that revolutionised the world.
Plus, we'll have a good old laugh as we look at comedy through the ages.
That's all to come. Plus, Tom Edwards with next week's news. Look ahead, and if you play your cards right, we'll have a track too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. I've got a bit of sort of snow stuck down my collar. It's like one of those things where you feel, you know, when you make a snow angel or when you build a snowman or when you go sledging, clearly the inevitable thing happens when someone throws a snowball down your neck.
But there's no snow in London.
There's no snow in London, but we've just finished Alpino. I feel that there's a little, there's a nip in the air, Andrew.
I wonder what you're referring to. Yes, we finished the last... I thought you were having a Nigella moment there or something. We have certainly finished the large newspaper, large format newspaper.
Yeah, I'm feeling kind of a little bit brisk. I'm feeling cold. I'm feeling kind of... Yeah, I'm now looking forward to all the sun that's going to be on the mountains.
Well, it's kind of a clear run between here and Christmas now. There's just lots of things to do, I guess. There's a clear run. There's a February issue to finish.
Yeah.
I've got one more trip.
Okay.
I'm going later today, because what's next?
We've got the man who knows what next week's news is. He's looking in his crystal ball. Or is it just a cheap snow globe? We'll find out after this. Tom Edwards coming up.
And now, from London, Camden's king of current affairs, the man who put the eek into Monocle Weekly, the ooh into the news. He once wrestled an angry mongoose. He doesn't sleep. He waits. He's about to open a can of whoop-ass on your week. And it's not even Monday. Undefeated, unflappable, and pretty much unheard of outside of digital radio, it's Monocle 24's news editor, Mr. Tom Edwards.
Wowee, Tom. I've sort of forgotten about that. Yeah,
still funny. Still funny now.
It's very funny.
He says through pursed lips.
Yeah,
it's Tommy Edwards. You can't argue with the man.
Just to refer very quickly back to your introduction, I'd love there to be you fighting that angry mongoose, sort of in a sort of Grace and Perry like tapestry.
Yeah, I think it would be good.
I'd love to see something like that.
Contemporary buyer effort.
Yeah.
It should need to be woven.
And with your giant whoop-ass showing as well.
never fight in such tiny shorts again.
Exactly. Heaven forbid.
Okay, we're going to do the news. Look ahead. Where are you going to start, Tom?
Yeah, well, I actually want to start with something that's happening today. Now, a lot of people would probably dismiss this as not being that newsworthy, but you'll both probably be aware that
Going down the pub?
I'm a big fan. Well, that's a daily occurrence, surely. You know, if it's 9 a.m, that's where the man's to be found.
My parents listen to this show.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to the Bounds. I'm fascinated by bees. I'm a big fan of bees. We've actually talked about bees, I think, on the weekly before. And the EU is imposing a sort of a ban on pesticides that are really dealing... potentially the death blow to
You're
bees
really
everywhere.
You're really worried about bees, aren't you?
I'm really worried about bees.
It's a constant source of concern to me.
I literally am always worried about them.
Well, this is a first continent-wide ban on particular chemicals. Now, some critics suggest that there's too many loopholes. You know, you can still use these pesticides in greenhouses on crops that bees find unattractive. I mean, I don't know how they're establishing this exactly. So, but I think at least it's an effort to step in the right direction, because we don't want Europe to... You know, be like some of these countries. There's whole vast tracts of the world where bees are gone almost altogether.
Like, that's bad news.
In parts of China, for example, they have to hand pollinate.
Hold on, you told me this story before, and I've tried to research this.
This is true.
You're going to have to prove it to me again afterwards. I can't find this. I can't find the proof.
I'll find you video of people painting pollen with little brushes.
I thought you were going to say I'll find you a video with no bees in it.
I said, well, there you go. Proof positive. But it's a good, it's a step in the right direction. I think we should applaud Dave at least for trying, even if it's a bit of a cop-out.
You met the bee sperm collector as well, didn't you?
There's all sorts I've spoken to. My interest in bees takes me high and low, unfortunately. But did you hear, even last week, just to show that there's always, bees are full of surprises, they can detect cancer, bees now.
Yeah. They're amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, just because there's dogs that can detect things like, you know, if you're about to have a fit or certain conditions, and they can warn you in advance. Bees can detect cancer. Let's harness the bee.
You can train them to tie your shoelaces in the morning as well. I've got two at home. You just sit there, you put your feet out, they tie your shoelaces before you go to work.
They are busy.
Yeah, tell you.
Fantastic. Anyway, the bee. Let's all herald the bee.
Yeah, let's herald the bee. I like a bee, and I'm sad about their demise.
But maybe this is a step in the right direction.
This isn't just a honey shortage, is it? It's just the fact that it's pollination. Well,
exactly, that's one manifestation. But it's bad for, you know, crops, fruit trees, other blossoming plants. It's terrible.
It's obviously leading me on to my favourite Eddie Izzard joke. I can't believe bees make honey. Do earwigs make chutney? Anyway.
Okay, next.
Right, well, tomorrow. Now, you're familiar with the concept of Black Friday. This follows Thanksgiving in the US, this crazy retail day. People pack in, the bricks and mortar shops are full to a bursting point. Cyber Monday is tomorrow. It's now the biggest spending day in the US. People don't like Black Friday anymore. Wrestling through the shops, the scrums. They're all going on the internet. I think this is another terrible development.
Really?
Get back into your shops. Can't just be on the interweb.
On the intraweb.
What's the point of that? No, but because we're all about, you know, bricks and mortar shops. This is a constant interest of ours at Monocle. I think this is another worrying development. So I think people in North America need to make sure they don't lose sight of the importance of having the goods in their hands.
Or even staying at home with your family for the day.
Exactly. But then they just excuse themselves and go and do furtive retail online.
Furtive retail.
Send the bees. Actually, when I was in the US recently, and there's this huge battle on between all the likes of Amazon to have these 1 hour deliveries. Mm. So in New York, you see all these guys where it's their job to be told so and so wants, you know, this lipstick. Okay, we'll get it for Tommy Edwards. And then they have 1 hour.
So they're literally there in shorts and sneakers.
Well, they're on. It's the revival of the cycle career. So they've got hundreds of them, and they're promising to deliver things within 1 hour.
That's quite a good story.
Yes.
Revival of the cycle career.
Let's send Tommy Edwards out to do that story with your little legs.
I'll get on one of those courier bikes. Probably be run over in 2 or 3 minutes.
You can't get a backy. You have to cycle it yourself.
I thought you were going to say the bees were involved somehow. Tie this lipstick onto that bee and send it out. So that's more sort of retail therapy of a slightly different kind.
Surreal music ahead, this is.
I like to tell you about some auctions, Rob, you know, that are coming up.
Yep.
Now, you know the sort of American sentimentalist Norman Rockwell?
I do.
So I think died in the sort of late 1970s, somewhere around there. Mm. Now, not everyone's taste, but there's a big auction this week, and they think it could be record prices. It's a bit like the sort of Jack Vetriano school, you know, love it or hate it. It's this very kind of illustrative style, but quite divisive. Apparently, one of the paintings, Saying Grace, you can imagine the schmaltz, could go for $20 million this week.
Really? For a Rockwell?
That's at Sotheby's, yeah. So it's kind of interesting that we keep seeing these record prices of late. We've had Bacon, that triptych, you know, old masters, contemporary works as well. It's interesting, it seems to be, again, this trend of people pouring money into, you know, investable art. And I'm rather surprised, I don't know about you, that Norman Rockwell's getting into that kind of league.
Weirdly, I think Norman Rockwell, he was kind of the original, schmaltz merchant in a way, but with a sense of, he definitely had a sense of irony. It wasn't like Jack Vetriano kind of just painting not very good paintings. It was, you know, there was an element of it. But also, there are people that have aped his style, you know, proper contemporary art, you know, from like George Condo to people have sort of have taken a little bit of that and taken it somewhere else. So he's kind of one of the sort of unsung heroes slightly. Well, he's obviously sung. If his paintings are going for 20 million, he's pretty sung.
But if you think of, the appearance of, say, you know, contemporary advertising, the advertising through, 50s, 60s, 70s, it wouldn't be the same, surely, without Norman Rockwell. Intriguing, I think.
Amazing. Is that your final one?
Well, I got one more, just a short one, because we're sort of, you know, we're drawing close towards Christmas time. Mm. I have a feeling I may even have mentioned this before, but of course...
What, Christmas?
On Tuesday... No.
Got some news. It's going to be Christmas on the 25th.
No, so it's the anniversary of 1992. Do you remember the dreaded... SMS text message, the first one.
Well,
of course,
every year is the anniversary.
Merry
of the
Christmas.
Year.
Well, yes, but it was Merry Christmas was the very first one.
Can I remember from you doing this last year?
Come on,
year,
can you remember the
Neil
name?
Papworth?
He has actually got it right.
I literally got it right.
Neil Papworth. So hats off to Neil Papworth.
Are you recycling your news?
Well, I like that one, and I was intrigued. I was going to say, can you remember?
That's so weird. Very weirdly weird. Good memory.
Who it was? Robert Brown, that's quite frightening.
He's all smug now.
I'm not smug, I'm just like...
Who did he send it to then, Rob? How about that?
Oh, I don't know.
Mrs. Papworth.
No, that was his mate, wasn't it?
It
said Merry Christmas.
It said Merry Christmas. It was his mate, Richard Jarvis. Yes. Roll on 2014, and we'll see if you've got that one in the memory banks.
Richard Jarvis. Well, listeners, stay tuned for 2015, so exactly. We can see. Yeah, brilliant. That was one of the weirdest news weekends ever. I loved it.
It had bees, it had shopping, it had paintings, and it had weird feats of memory recall.
And it had you, Tom.
Exactly. Back after about a month.
I know.
Because last week we did it, and it was Thomas Lewis that did News Look Ahead.
Oh, that was,
he was quite
was,
good,
that
wasn't
was a quality look ahead.
It was good.
I don't think he had any bees.
It was buzz, but not that kind of buzz.
Nice, I like it.
Oh, yeah. There's always a sting in the tail, isn't
there?
Oh, yes. Here's the bee's knees. Tom Edwards, thank you very much for your News Look Ahead. And welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Now, the United States may be considered the most powerful nation on Earth today, but of course, it started from humble beginnings. When the 13 original British colonies declared independence in 1776, its future as a country was far from secure. Instead, the US, in its infancy, had a host of problems and conflicting ideologies.
But somehow, through the uncertainty, the United States managed to survive. A new book titled The Men Who United the States takes a look at some of the great American explorers and industrialists who helped build the country, from the interstate highway system to the first continental telegraph. Well, joining us now in the studio is the author of the book, Simon Winchester. Welcome to the programme, Simon. I was looking through the book today, and once again, there's a good chapter on geology where you go underneath the United States. And I know that you started off your life as a geologist, and I was looking through all the books you've done and doing some research on you today. Who would have thought
you say digging
no,
up?
But okay, who would have thought that geology would have laid the bedrock, as it were, for such a writing career? Is that something you try even today to weave into most things you do? Geology, for you, really is the foundation of most things you look at.
Well, I mean, everything in this room derives from geology. I mean, your computer came from the earth, the trees, the wood, everything. So it is hugely important. And if you're writing a book about history of any sort, then it makes sort of sense to me anyway that you at least give a little nod to geology. I think my editor in New York is getting a bit weary about tectonic plates. He said, no, for God's sake, no more tectonic plates. But I think there are actually no tectonic plates mentioned in this book. No animals were hurt in the making of this book. No tectonic plates are mentioned.
Have you searched the index, Andrew, just to check?
I will check. I'll look under T while you ask the next question.
We will put a hefty asterisk on that comment. Who knows? Okay. I wanted to go slightly above ground, Simon, and ask you about the topography and the cartology as well. Cartography.
Cartography. Cartology is a very good word.
That's the right word. Cartology. It's just a new word.
Yes, well, it's the mot juste.
And how important maps were, how important, whether the men that star in your book are inventors, generals, there's map makers as well. That's clearly a very important thing in the Westward Ho, right?
Yes, I mean, hugely important, the making of maps. And the first expedition was this famous one by Lewis and Clark, sent out in 1803 after the Louisiana Purchase had effectively tripled the size of America and made it extend from sea to shining sea, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The making of the maps, which really, well, it was a sort of salutary lesson for me here, because I'd written a book in 2001 called The Map That Changed the World about a very important geological, I'm sorry to go back to geology for a second, which hangs in the Geological Society of London in Piccadilly. And this map, made in 1815, was the first geological map of anywhere. So I thought, and wrote a book about it. But it turns out that a Scotsman called William McClure, completely obscure fellow to most people these days, made a geological map of the eastern United States, of the Appalachians, in 1809. So my publishers in London said, well, you know, the sales of The Map That Changed the World are slowly declining after 12 years, so why don't we relaunch it and call it The Second Map That Changed the World? We'll make a bit more money out of it. But no, it's true. I mean, maps generally, geological maps specifically, tremendously important in the making of any country. And there's this incredibly important place, totally obscure, called East Liverpool, Ohio, outside which there is an obelisk, stands forlornly by the side of the road, ignored by everybody, covered with graffiti and litter. And that is known as the point of beginning, because the very first surveys that were done in 1785 where a line was drawn 82 degrees west of Greenwich and another one 48 degrees north of the equator, and from that all the survey lines in America originate, is known as the Point of Beginning. It's in East Liverpool, Ohio, a forlorn former crockery-making city, which is a typical broken-down Rust Belt city now. Nobody in America knows of the existence of this forlorn chunk of marble, but it's where the American story began in terms of cartology or cartography.
You say potato.
Simon, I wanted to ask you, you're newly properly minted American, and you've spent much of your life there. And many of the people in this book were not people who had been there for generations. They were people who were new to America and were determined to help build this country. How important is that as you, the outsider, the migrant, the person who sees the country afresh?
Well, hugely important. And of course, in the early part of America, almost everyone that invented anything had to come from overseas. But it is extraordinary how many Celts are involved, how many Welshmen, look at Alexander Graham Bell, Scotsman who invented the telephone. Samuel Morse was homegrown, the inventor of the telegraph, of course, although his realization that electrical impulses could be transmitted, and he discovered that or realized this when he was on a boat coming forlornly back from Paris and had a discussion in the middle of an Atlantic Ocean storm about this idea that an electrical spark could transmit a signal. And he went back and immediately invented the Morse tapper, which changed everything. This famous patent number 1647 in, I think, 1842, which allowed America and indeed anyone to talk instantaneously from coast to coast. Almost everyone in these stories, whether it's McAdam, the man who allowed roads to be made because he determined that the size of the pebbles should be small enough to fit in your mouth and could thus be crushed by wagon wheels, and suddenly the construction of roads became possible and road travel became feasible instead of bumping over boulders or logs of wood. Nearly all of these people were from outside, and an awful lot of them from Scotland and Wales, which is, to me, rather peculiar.
I'm sort of reminded of Henry Ford's quote about, if I asked people what they wanted, they'd have asked for a faster horse in all of this as well. it's kind of interesting always to dissect the battle between different forms of communication as well, maybe roads versus the railways. That was obviously certainly part of the architecture of the westward movement as well, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I'm just thinking the bizarre things in this book. Aeroplanes, moving further forward. The first transcontinental flight was performed by this remarkable playboy, really, Calbraith Rogers, his name was, who was deaf and smoked a cigar. And you've got to remember, these are open aircraft. You think a cigar would burn incredibly quickly when you're going over the landscape at 50 miles an hour. But the plane that did it, which was a Wright Flyer, bought from the Wright brothers in Dayton, Ohio, was painted pink for a start. And he carried a bottle underneath him of a disgusting drink called Vin Fizz. Now, Vin Fizz was made by the Armour Meat Company because Philip Danforth Armour, a great unknown pioneer in America, reasoned that every single part of a cow should be edible, should be used by humankind. And so everything, with the hooves and horns made glue and the fur made coats and the meat was eaten, the fat was made into soap and so forth. And he was one day looking at the effluent that came out from the slaughterhouses and saw this sort of pink slime, not the kind of pink slime that we now know are in many hamburgers, but a different kind of pink slime. And he said, I think this is attractive enough that if we diluted it with water, add a bit of sugar and some soda water, we can make a drink. And he called it Vin Fizz. And he tried to peddle it to America, and no one wanted to buy it because, as I think I say in the book, it's best drunk cold or preferably not at all. And he said, I know, I will sponsor this man, Calbraith Rogers, who wants to fly across America, if he'll paint the word Vin Fizz and a bunch of grapes and carry a bottle of it. And he did, and America was bridged by air. It didn't help the sales of Vin Fizz, and Vin Fizz disappeared, thank God.
I thought there was going to be an apocryphal tale where Coca-Cola was born there.
That'd be lovely. But not apocryphal is the fact that once having completed the journey, he then decided to do a few aerobatics and plunged into the sea and killed himself.
Simon, do you think there's something in the air about trying to understand America at this point? Because I'm sure that you're going to be rubbing up a book cover against book cover in the bestseller list with Mr. Bill Bryson, who's done a book this year about understanding all of America and the making of America via one year, 1927. Is that just coincidence, or do you think there's something in the air that, you know, this is a huge country that we're always grappling to understand? And that, you know, writers like you, and it's interesting that he's an American and came here and wrote lots of books about Britain. You're a Brit who's gone there and who's kind of understanding America. Do you think there's something in the air?
I think there is. I mean, there is back in America something in the air, because the country is tremendously depressed at the moment, as you might imagine. I mean, it realizes that it is unpopular around the world internally. I mean, you've had all the schisms with the Tea Party and the breakdown of government, the closure of government recently. Obama is floundering at the moment. There's a feeling that, for God's sake, what's wrong with us? And I think Bill, who's an old friend, wanted to do much the same, to say that for all the temporary shortcomings, these things will pass. America has been through terribly bad times in its history and survived them all, and the Civil War, Depression, the Dust Bowl, the assassination of a president, the Vietnam War, the great recent recession, 9/11, all of these things. And America has this constant ability to regenerate itself and pick itself up. And I wanted to say in this book that, you know, despite what's going on in Washington, America itself is a lot better than the politicians it elects and sends to the Capitol, and that people should be a little more encouraged. The country has great determination and energy, and I think both Bill and I feel exactly the same way. It is a marvellous, marvellous place, although he chooses to live here.
It's a one-in-one-out policy, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
For writers on America, it's very fair. It's firm, but it's
indeed
fair.
Indeed, it is firm, but fair, yes.
I wonder whether in the pages of your book you can sort of extrapolate a golden age for how united, when the United States was the most united. Was it at its sort of first, when it first became an entity, or does it become more united as it goes on? I wonder if there's a way.
Well, I think in a perhaps a rather poignant way, it becomes more united when faced with tragedy. Mm. I mean, I had met President Kennedy in 1963 when I was hitchhiking around the country. He was opening a lock on the St. Lawrence Seaway in Sault Ste. Marie in Michigan. And I was moved, as everyone was, by his simple presence. I mean, he was a remarkable figure. And in those, it would be unfair to say that the country was united while he was a living president, because there were places like Dallas where there was profound antipathy towards him. But the moment a president was shot dead and the moment 9/11 occurred, the country came together like seldom before. So I think tragedy brings America together in a profoundly important way.
And that's something other than simply planting a flag on your front lawn, isn't it? There's presumably something in the air, something cogent.
Yes, I mean, I live in a small village. I have a flat in New York, but most of the time I'm in a small village in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, a village of just 700 people, and we have our flags out on Memorial Day. Mm. And I must say, Memorial Day specifically, the beginning of summer, is a moment when certainly my village and all of America feels at one with itself.
Talking about a different Berkshire, Crowthorne in Berkshire. That's how I first started reading you, The Surgeon of Crowthorne. And I was in a bookshop in New York the other day, and I saw it's called The Murderer and the Madman, which is a title I believe that you...
The Professor and the Madman.
Oh, the Professor and the Madman, yes. I apologise. But I believe it's a title you chose yourself. Is that just something you've learnt over time, that Crowthorne in Berkshire, England isn't much of a selling point? Or this book has got a great title. Is this something you think about a great deal, the titles of the book?
Well, I do. But I mean, just to get it right, The Surgeon of Crowthorne was my title.
I mean,
because he was a surgeon. He was a military surgeon.
And I grew up near Crowthorne. I loved it.
And you probably remember the alarm going off 10 o'clock every Monday morning, as it still goes off to this day. But no, I invented that. But my American editor said, what the hell's a Crowthorne? I mean, no one's going to buy a book with the word Crowthorne in the title. Let's call it, and he came up with The Professor and the Madman. And at first I recoiled in a very sort of British way, because no one in the story is a professor. But he said, don't worry about it. And sort of 3.5 million copies later, I don't worry about it. I think that was the right title. And interestingly, I mean, the thing that I'm in a way most proud about recently is that the Folio Society is publishing this book, and that is a great accolade. And they're publishing it under the title, despite them being a British-based company, are publishing it under the title The Professor and the Madman, because that's what most people know, although I'm delighted that you still known my old original title.
Maybe you should have even called it Sex Professor and the Madman.
That'd be wonderful. Yeah. Why not?
That's sex eminently Googleable. Don't do an image search on that. That's a very strange... We've got a strange image in my head. Simon, thank you so much. Before we go, you've got to tell us where you got your trousers from. Simon's wearing the most amazing wear of yellow cords.
I was in Paris and I met a man walking outside the Rodin Museum who was wearing these trousers, and I went up to him and I said, in a very fractured French, where did you get them? And he said, au Berthet, on Rue de Solferino. So I said, he said, 5 minutes away. So I went up there and there they were. There was one pair in bright yellow and a pair in bright pink. And figuring that a real man can wear pink proudly,
absolutely,
I decided to buy them, and here they are.
Nice. And looking damn fine today, too.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the way that we should end an interview about the history of the United States of America. Why ever not? Exactly. Exactly. Simon Wichter, author of The Men Who United the States, which is out now. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you, both of you. Thank you.
Learning from a master is a privilege in any sphere. To nurture ideas for the arts, Rolex's Mentor and Protégé initiative has been teaming leading practitioners with promising protégés around the globe. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound hopped over to Venice to talk to some protégés and mentors.
Everybody's moved out of institutional thinking and behavior and moved into something that's way easier, more honest, more direct, and more collaborative. As an artist, it's not interesting to be a private genius. What you want is to be part of a movement.
You can watch Rob Bound's film on monocle.com.
Time for a track now. This is new from Canadian group Austra. This is Forgive Me.
That was the new release from Austra. Oh, I always said Austra. Is it Austra?
I think it could be either.
Okay, we'll choose. We'll let the listeners choose.
Let them choose. Let them choose the right way for a band to be pronounced.
Well, that's their fault, isn't it? They should have chosen a less easily to confuse name. Anyway, I've got the track right. It's Forgive Me.
Yeah.
Rather suitable in this instance. And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. 1963. It was the year that changed the world, at least according to author Robin Morgan. It was a year that saw such fundamental moments as the assassination of US President John F. Kennedy, the race into space, and the rise of a new youth movement using music, art, and fashion to influence decision makers and more.
It was also the year that saw the rise of some of the most influential figures and bands in the 20th century, Mick and Keith from the Rolling Stones, Dylan, and of course the Beatles. It was these figures, as Robin argues, that helped radically transform the world. And we're happy to be joined by Robin, author of 1963, The Year of Revolution, in the studio now. Robin, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
And this was the watershed year. This was the year when all these kind of conflicting passions, emotions, skills, the class divide fell to pieces. This is that you can track it to this one year.
Yeah, I think in any era of history, there's a tectonic moment where something happens. And it's almost an alchemy which changes the lives of people and changes history. The premise of this book is that 1963 was the 60s. It's when the 60s really began. Before 63, youth, particularly working class youth in Britain, were cannon fodder. They were factory fodder. After 63, youth was commercially, politically, socially, culturally, so significant that presidents, prime ministers and royalty wanted to be seen with them. It could never have happened before.
And there was a link up. There was a link up as well between, as you said, royalty and governments and presidents and prime ministers wanting to hang with people that would have been seen as dangerous. There was obviously a bit of they obviously had to sort of look at the scales a bit to see whether they were going to be down with the kids, but also whether they were going to be exposed in some way by hanging out with the Beatles, especially not the Stones.
I think what we're looking at is really the birth of celebrity notoriety. Before 63, politicians, royalty, and perhaps Hollywood stars were globally household notorious names. After 63, working class kids, within minutes, days, weeks, could become globally significant. Take January 63. The Beatles were nobody. They were in Abbey Road recording an album with George Martin, which would go to number one a month later. That same night in 63 that they were recording their first television appearance for ITV, a young kid called Bob Dylan was on the BBC. He was nobody. He was unknown. He'd been bought over to act in a BBC play because the producer thought he was interesting. Producer realised he couldn't act, but he'd heard him sing to his au pairs, actually. He was staying with the producer because he'd been thrown out of a hotel where he'd been smoking pot. So that same night, the Beatles and Bob Dylan, virtual nobodies on a world stage, were appearing on British television. There were only two channels in Britain at the time. 1 year later, the Beatles are performing to 73 million Americans, a third of the population of America. 1 year later, Bob Dylan is already changing up the entire protest movement against civil rights, Vietnam, talking about social change in America. These guys in 1 year became the poster boys, the messiahs of this revolution. When we go back to January in 63, who else was around? Eric Clapton joined a band. David Barry formed a band. He was 16 at school. Elton John was playing hooky from the Royal College of Music and playing Chopin and to play honky-tonk piano in London coffee bars. The Animals were forming in Newcastle. The Supremes were changing their name from the Primettes in Detroit. All of this stuff was happening. The Stones formed in January 63. What was so special about this year was that within 63, these kids, these nobodies, went from nothing to a year later being invited to the White House.
And Robin, what is it special about? You know, obviously, these people are all around and they're ready to do their thing in 1963. But is it a coincidence, the timing, that all of these stars are aligned? Or is it because, just actually when you look back, it's only actually 18 years since the end of the Second World War. Did it take the world that long to get over, you know, the austerity and the hardship of the end of war to be ready to party again, as it were? What was the moment that happened in 63?
The DNA of 63 and the 60s and this revolution is very much about World War II. It's about rebuilding in America, in Britain, and in Europe. It's about people who'd fought that war and been through that war wanting something better for their kids. It's about their kids facing 3 years of national service in Britain or 3 years in the draft in America. Elvis himself had to do the draft in Germany. Suddenly, in 1960-61, the draft in America is downgraded. National service ends in Britain. And as Keith Richard tells us, you know, throughout the 50s as kids, they were being told by their parents, oh, the army will sort you out. When you do national service, it'll sort you out. And then he said, well, suddenly we had these 3 years back. They'd ended it. We didn't have to go in the army. Whoopee. What are we going to do? Oh, I'm going to pick up a guitar. I'm going to pick up a pencil and paper and design a dress. I'm going to pick up a camera and take photographs. I mean, these kids, just working class kids in Britain, just suddenly realized that the world was their oyster and they had 2 or 3 years back that they hadn't planned on, where they didn't have to get serious. They didn't have to do the jobs their parents had done. Their parents wanted something different for them. They wanted something different. And it all coalesced around 63. Mary Quant invented the mini dress. The pill became available freely for girls to experiment without fear.
And presumably, Robin, there's an idea that, mentioning all these people, there was an idea that all these people that grew up and became so creative. I know that the style in which the book is told is anecdotes from key people of the year, of the era, and of, obviously specifically of the year, telling their side of the story and riffing on that thing, from Keith Richards to Andrew Oldham to Mary Quant and all the rest of it. I guess there was an element, as Andrew is suggesting, that if you grew up playing on a bomb site, as so many of these people did, you wanted to do something to react against that. You wanted to escape it with a guitar or designing something short for the girls.
A crucial element is prosperity and freedom. These kids could get a job one day, and if they didn't like it, they could have a new job the next day. Prosperity was key. You could earn £6 a week. You could rent a one-bedroom flat in Notting Hill for £1 a week. You could buy a new suit of clothes for £2 a week. Right? What did food matter? That was pretty cheap. So their money went a lot further. They were buying fashion to dance in, to club in, to enjoy. They were experimenting with their identity in a time of great freedom and prosperity, which probably hasn't been replicated since and had never been before for young people. What's really interesting, and you use the word riffing, which is so important in this book. There were two different tectonics in Britain and America. In Britain, it was very much working class led. It was working class kids who were buying Mary Quant. It was working class kids who were buying Barbara Hulnicki and Bieber. It was working class kids who were aspiring to go to a Vidal Sassoon salon and have a 5-point bob. It was working class girls who wanted to be models, certainly lower middle class girls like Jean Shrimpton, who wanted to be models. Working class kids like David Bailey and Terry O'Neill, who were picking up cameras and taking photographs. The rock bands we all know about. You take Jeff Lynne, the great record producer, Electric Light Orchestra, Traveling Wilburys, the man that every great recording artist from Dylan and Roy Orbison to the modern day would want to work with. He was 16 in 1963. He learned to play guitar on a plastic guitar with one string. I mean, it's absolutely crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
None of these great guitarists in Britain, these working class kids, could read a note of music. None of them were classically trained, apart from Elton. You look across the Atlantic to America, and the voices of the day, the Neil Sedakas, the Elvises, the Frank Sinatras, they were still topping the charts.
Obviously, the names that you've featured in your book are people that are notable, and that's why we want to go back and revisit the year through their eyes. Mm. But there was a lot of business sense. You talked to Frank Lowe in the book, for example, one of the great ad men of any age. And obviously, you speak to former Stones and Mary Quant and Bailey and all these people. They've stayed at the top of their game.
Oh, and not only that, Sir Alan Parker.
Yeah.
Frank Lowe was born above a pub. Sir Alan Parker, the great film director, chairman of the BFI, and I was a working class kid from North London. You know, these guys would never have got a look in or a job in that. David Putnam, Lord Putnam, would never have got a job looking in an advertising agency. It was the Mad Men days when only army officers got executive jobs at ad agencies. David Putnam remembers this wonderful moment in 1963. He's in the ad agency, and the boss of the agency brings their most important client into his little room in the back of the building, opens the door and said, "And this is our young man." Youth had become a commodity being introduced to people. It was suddenly important. And the really intriguing thing about it is that it was very organic and street-led and started in Britain and hit America because the BBC, commercial television and radio, the American, they didn't play this music. They just played the music of these guys in tuxedos, crooners and balladeers. But so much was happening on the street and at street level with the Mary Quants, with the girls, with the models, with the bands. They couldn't ignore it anymore. Then the man at Decca who turned down the Beatles signed the Stones because he realized he'd made a mistake and turned down the Beatles.
Yeah.
Only 2 months later, after turning down the Beatles. And I think that for me, what I set out with this book to tell their story, and it wasn't about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was about what was it like to be that young and that free in this year that changed lives. And that's why everybody, these are very cynical people. They've been around for 50 years. They've done all of the interviews. You know, their managements protect them. You can't get to them. And a lot of them we couldn't get to. So we had to find other ways to get to them. And when we did get to them, they were so effusive, so overjoyed that somebody wanted to write about that spirit of being young and innocent and naive in 63. And they all bought into the concept because they all recognized it was an absolutely truthful concept. Their lives were changed in 1 year. And one of the sadnesses that comes through the book is that how their success changed their lives and took over their lives. And they missed 63 like crazy because it was their year of freedom, their year of revolution when they were at the cutting edge of just changing the world, and they didn't even know they were doing it.
I guess it was that scenario of 2 years later they got proper jobs, but it was the same one. It was just more professional.
Yeah,
right?
their fun became proper jobs.
The book is 1963, The Year of the Revolution. Robin Morgan is the author. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This Christmas, gather up your elves, load up the sleigh, and head to Midori House for our annual Christmas fair. We'll be hosting our favourite nations and retailers, mixing up Swiss Weihnachten and Japanese Kurisumasu with traditional Yuletide cheer. You can stock up on Christmas presents for your loved ones, pet our reindeer, enjoy performances from our musical guests. You can even meet our Finnish VIP, Santa Claus. It's all happening at Midori House at 1 Dorset Street from 11am to 5pm on the 7th and 8th of December.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Now it's time to flex your funny bone, because hopefully, just hopefully, we'll be able to make you laugh along with this next chat. The stand-up comedian's job has virtually remained unchanged. Stand in front of a crowd, make a few jokes, and hopefully have the audience in stitches.
But what does it take to connect with audiences and make them laugh? What's the best approach to comedy, and has it changed over the past 100 years? John Fisher first published A Funny Way to Be a Hero in 1973, and it's regarded as one of the best books on 20th century comedy. 40 years later, Funny Way to Be a Hero is being republished, with 6 new chapters and hundreds of illustrations too. We're delighted to say we're joined in the studio by the author, John Fisher. John, first of all, just tell us, how come you've managed to pull off this coup by getting a book republished 40 years after it first hit the bookshelf stand?
I think persistence is required, but I was well aware that the book wasn't finished, because when I sat down all that time ago to address the top comedians of the 20th century, I could only draw to a conclusion those who figured in the first part of the century, people like Max Miller and the Crazy Gang. The more modern comedians at that point that I was writing about, the Frankie Howards, the Ken Dodds, the Morkman Wisers, their careers were still in full flight. What I've been able to do 40 years on is now to draw their stories to a conclusion, and, of course, to add some more chapters of people who were unjustly overlooked first time around.
But when you picked up that manuscript, as it were, from 40 years ago, and you looked at the names that you had written about then as the top flight talent of the time, had you been a kind of a good better? Had you picked the right names? How many of them really had kind of stayed with us to today? Or when you came to relook at that script, were there many of the names which actually had faded from our memories and hadn't really kind of stood the test of time?
It's interesting, because when I show the new book to people who aren't necessarily specialists in the subject, the thing they comment is that virtually all the names who have a chapter to them are recognisable, almost as if they've become sort of folk heroes. The George Formbys and the Rob Wiltons and the Crazy Gang and Tommy Cooper, all these guys, they've entered our subconscious, I think. So I don't know that it was a question of making a bet at the time, because I wasn't writing about anybody who was not successful. I wasn't sitting down to pick future winners, as it were. That's a whole other story. But no, I think the people I write about have held a position, more or less. Yes, I'd grant you one or two. Perhaps Jimmy Edwards isn't remembered as fondly today as Tommy Cooper would be, and as Morkman Wise obviously are. Tony Hancock, I think, still resonates with the people who listened to him in his prime, etc.
It's two big thumbs up from us, isn't it?
John, one of the chapters is headed, Are Women Funny? Now, when you ran through the names at the beginning of this interview, there weren't any women that popped up there. And actually, you know, the reality is that through time, women have found it harder to get to the top of the comedy ladder. I think, is there a comedy ladder? You probably fall off a
it's
comedy ladder.
Got a few
ladder,
missing rungs, yeah, yes. I think. Yeah.
I don't know whether it's that they have found it harder. I think it's a question that fewer women have attempted it. There's some brilliant funny women from the period I'm writing about, people like Hilda Baker and an act called Gert and Daisy, Elsie and Doris Waters, who were like the French and Saunders of their day, a wonderful comedian called Suzette Tarry. They were all big stars at the time, just as today Victoria Wood and French and Saunders again are big stars. But it is inescapable that the role of the stand-up stroke stage comedian is more a masculine preoccupation than a feminine one, just as the world of nursing is more a feminine preoccupation rather than a masculine
one. It's a slightly solipsistic existence, isn't it? And that seems to be more of a masculine thing. There's an ego to this, isn't there?
Yeah. Also, you do require, when you are out on stage challenging an audience to laugh at you, you do require a certain aggression you've got to come up them. You can't suffer fools in that audience. And it's harder for a female, I think, generally speaking.
One of the other interesting things about that, this chapter is many of the women are actually men. So it does
very much. Yes, yes.
For example, we're talking about Dame Edna, and you know, amazing the tradition of always having a, you know, in our kind of British comedy pantheon, at least one man who likes to put on a frock. And why is it that you, do you think that, where does that come from, that real tradition of men being funny dressed up as women?
I think comedy is all about turning reality on its head. And if you analyse the silent clowns, you can see they're drawing attention to the inconsequentialities of life. You know, the whole thing about comedy is, I don't want to sound too academic, but there's this sort of Saturnalian aspect. Let's go to hell, let's hang our hair out. And surely the idea of dressing up, cross-dressing, that's right, would fall into that. But of course, in the early music hall, you did have it the other way round as well. You had people like, I don't go into them in the book, but Hetty King and Vesta Tilly, who came out and gave impressions of men in uniform, particularly around the time of the First World War, and so on. So it is a bit of a crossover. Although, of course, in pantomime, where we see the dame played by a man, that is a more robust comedy role than the principal boy, who perhaps not so much now, but going back, would have been played by a female.
Yeah, there's a bit of paganism in that, yeah, in the pantomime as
paganism
well.
Paganism is a good
and
word.
Elizabethan,
yeah,
theatre, obviously, was all about cross-dressing and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with it, Andrew. It's fine. I don't want to tell that this is what you're wearing.
I could tell them. I could tell them about an incident or two as well, Rob. But anyway, we'll keep that for afterwards.
I wanted to ask you, John, also about, we've talked about the necessary ego and confidence to stand on stage. We've talked about Tony Hancock as well. We should also mention the fragility of this. How ripe for picking of the truth of comedians? I mean, how easy is it to bore down into what they were really like?
I've written a whole biography of Hancock, and the more you dissect that sad life on the one hand, but nevertheless an extremely successful life from his professional point of view, you realise that they are battling against perfection, that you go out there on a stage, you make an audience laugh, you come off, you're energized to go on again because you want to hear that laughter again. Hearing the laughter becomes an obsession, so that's why you do it. But at the same time, they want to make it better. They want to make it more perfect. So if you have particularly somebody like Hancock, who got into the rhythm of doing a half-hour show weekly, whether for radio or television, just think of that challenge. And it's not too difficult to imagine that getting on top of somebody. Just at the same time, you can also imagine somebody who's essentially a stage performer having to go on night after night after night and basically rework the same material for a different audience. And so, those are the pressures. But as I said, it requires a great deal of guts to get out there in the first place. I'm often asked, what do these guys all have in common? They had the courage, they had the sense of timing, which sounds a bit of a cliche, but nevertheless, there was a moment in the telling of a joke or a story when the moment becomes right, when you've got to let go for the audience to laugh. And they all shared, I think, a slight shift in attitude. It's being able to see the world slightly out of kilter. That's sort of summed up for me by the way Eric Morecambe looked, by the way Tommy Cooper would stand. Imagine the way Jack Tatty would walk down the street. Mm. It's just slightly otherworldish, out of this worldish.
It is indeed a funny way to be the hero. The author is John Fisher, and the book In Bumper Form is out now. John, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you both.
And there we have it.
Very good show. Can I tell you, I was on the book tour, the end of the book tour in the Nordic regions. Met very, very, very lots of nice people, including lots who listened to you and me.
Oh, really? That's nice.
It's a bit sobering, actually.
Oh. No, 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 I hate good. It when you say that.
There was a very nice gentleman in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
He's probably listening now because he downloads the show to two different phones so he can have different circumstances. He listens to Monocle 24 all the time. He knew more about the playlist than I do. And
he'll probably be the man that writes in and says, you pronounce Austria like Austria yeah. rather than Austria like Auslander.
I had another conversation with someone who said, I did a link to the interview you did with the gentleman from Afghanistan on my on a social media page. But anyway, saying it was one of the, he was saying how important it was. Suddenly it makes you realise.
That's nice, isn't it?
We've got to make sure our socks are always pulled up.
Look at my sock.
Ooh, and that's... I thought that was a bit of a half-calf sock because you've got the kind of... Rob's got like striped socks, but the middle stripe is quite flesh-coloured. I thought it was like a little ankle sock at first.
It's just a tiny little sock and then a tattoo on the, on the rest of a weird orange tattoo on the
rest of it. It's very nice, a bit fleshy around the ankle. It could confuse...
You could think that that's... Yeah,
you've got a half sock on, but no, you've got a full sock.
Like these little tennis socks that ladies have, a little bubble on the back.
It's not just ladies.
on that attractive bombshell, we'll leave it. On that sartorial bombshell. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be here again, same time, same place, but possibly different personnel next week. Who knows? But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.